Hello, welcome to Literally from the North Shore. We're glad you are tuned in. We continue today with Connie Ellis's reading of Shelter Half by Minnesota author Carol Bly, a novel about a handful of people in a northern Minnesota town. We pick up now where Connie left off last time.
Chapter 4. At just before 4 o'clock on Friday afternoon, no one except Vern Denham himself was left in his building at Rack Chemical. He was quitting. For all the times that Vern had quit jobs, the happiness of leaving leapt up in him each time, leaving. He went along the silvery anti-personnel fence. The whole campus of Rack Chemical was silent. He heard only the traffic on the interstate. When a company has 20% growth right along for a number of years, like Rack, needn't and doesn't hire riffraff for security. Rack's armed people were never particularly visible, yet they were always about, mostly near or inside Five Lab. Oh, Vern thought, he was quitting. He was passing it now, the Earth Berm Institute of Humane Research that Rack staff called Five Lab. Vern had admired the outside of that building from the day he was interviewed 2 years ago for the job at Rack Chem. The building had one free above-ground face entirely windowed in a steep roofed assembly of glass. Its eaves were deep and low, precisely designed to let winter, but not summer, sunshine through all that glass. The architectural idea was a 1990s concept of rich people's workplaces designed to look like rich people's play places. Five Lab looked like a Swiss ski hotel. Five Lab was a first for Rack because Rack had been just a conventional mid-sized chemical company organized in 1955. In a dozen years or so, it had eaten its growth potential. 4 years ago, the president bought a rundown adjoining site, put up the Institute for Humane Research, announced its project of looking for an absolute cure for red steel and other molds of interest to Minnesota and Wisconsin truck farmers. Now, Vern marched along with heightened feeling. It was as if he could literally see further. He felt the presence of small things, places where the silver was chipped away from the fence. He could already smell Rack's weekend smell, piney from the spaced shrubberies. All weekend the campus would be free of chemical effluence. He felt how sharp and clean Rack's setup was at all times. Rack was the first orderly workplace Vern had ever experienced. When nothing much was going on at lumber and construction firms, which, like Rack, ran to a lot of woven anti-personnel fencing, the yards and dock drive-ins still looked as if violent work might start up at any moment. Piles of lumber and half-unwrapped divic or neat Lincoln log piles of 4x6s lay around. You felt that at any minute a troop of men might appear, still wiping sandwich crumbs from their plaid shirts, replacing their helmets. Rack, on the other hand, left nothing lying around. And why would it? Vern thought. Chemical companies work with nearly invisible material. Chemistry is the ideas inside objects, not objects themselves. Construction companies, sooner or later, show everything they have here and there, right up front. When they have finished a building project, what you see and have been seeing is what you get. How different with Rack. Vern had done promotions and image making for the company. It was over 2 years now, yet still he didn't grasp the crux of those chemists' work. Like any chem lecturer or teacher, he knew some of the logic and a few formulas by heart. He taught them to high school and vocational kids, but those letters and numbers and subscriptures had no real home in his brain. Vern grabbed hold of the administration door. Not exactly for the last time. He would want at least a week to get his present projects into other hands. Still, nearly the last time, he felt the heft of what he was doing. This might be the end of himself and Emma Jean Tenebrae. It was her father who had gotten Vern this very high-end employment, the first he'd ever really had. Good old Dad Peter. Well, perhaps Vern would have to kiss goodbye. Goodbye to any more of the cheery, almost intellectual family dinners at the Tenebrae's. Old Peter himself doing the cuisine. Natalie plenty juiced for the evening by that hour, but still on her feet, and Imogen cutting them Stilton because the Tenebrae's ate Stilton from Thanksgiving time through the Epiphany. Vern imagined Imogen's oddly pretty face. You thought twice about such a woman. Vern had dropped in several times in her part-time workplace in Duluth. A shabby place, that was. Women for Peace had the basement of some old failed church. In the director's office, Imogen sometimes swooped down to pick up and stroke pets people brought in. Someone else's middle-sized dog often lay curled in her lap. Vern found Imogen once resting the elbow of her mouse hand on the haunch of a very mangy-looking creature. When Vern first took to dropping in when he had to be in Duluth for anything, he had reached out a hand to pet the dog. It raised its nose exactly 1 inch above Imogen's thighs, gave a growl from deep as China. Imogen had grinned. That's his best quality, she said. Everyone else around this place is so nonviolent, you could choke, but not that dog, at least. Vern smiled now, recalling it. But when he recalled her long hair she would toss heavily back, his heart shook. He turned off the thought because now he was inside Rack administration. Listen, 1 minute away from quitting. 4 more doors down the echoey hall. He wore his most serious suit because Rack's monitors were always on, making film whenever someone wasn't watching. Next week, next month, he didn't want Rack's last view of him to show a nervous-looking man of 30 making a major life career mistake, quitting. His shirt was fine, tie good, haircut. He felt that if he quit the job wearing iron cords and a sports jacket casually, Friday code, they would decide and dictate into his employment record that Vern Denham seemed to be going to seed anyway. Vern wasn't a city man. Never mind that he had been to college and he had 10 years off and on of employment, all of it in cities. He was a rural northern person. He was the only person he knew who loved to go back to his parents' house. Their second-floor apartment, the long, comfortable sprawl of it, right over the bakery itself. Alongside other apartments they rented to old people. Vern didn't want to be reminded of boyhood, but of young boyhood, of delicious earlier returns from college, from jobs he got fired from or jobs he had quit. He didn't pine for the Thanksgiving dinners of boyhood. His relationship with his dad and mother merely so-so. Not sad, not painful, merely casual. Each time he came home, some job ended, his dad would say, "Now what happened this time?" Each time, Vern liked telling him what happened anyway. His dad always looked doubtful. The two men didn't read each other very well. It was his mother who didn't flinch from her serf-like loyalty. She would always say, "I guess everyone can't be so lucky as to have the Tenebrae family to work for." Then she would add, "Your dad never quit a job in his life." Vern's parents lived in the dream world of serfs then. They licked up a lot of crow from one Tenebrae or another. When Vern's dad had been gardener and property supervisor for the old grandfather, Cornelius Tenebrae, and after that for his son James, and only recently for Peter, part-time, he wasn't galled at being called the Tenebrae family's man, as if he were a serf. As a boy, Vern had been mesmerized by how his dad beamed when one or another Tenebrae slapped his shoulder. Vern never insulted his father. A previous girlfriend or two had thought him kind to the old man. That wasn't it. It was that he had known since he was 15 or 16 that he himself was dull. It didn't show on the outside. On the outside, he was like any American who could imitate a smiley weather anchor. In fact, Peter Tenebrae early took Vern for a natural speaker. It was only inside himself that Vern knew he was dull. Not thick-headed like his high school classmates, not unthinking like old Kenny, who had become a mechanic for Garris Otto's. He grieved at this dullness about himself, but could always gear up and be lively, even rowdy, when he had to be. He had to hide much. For example, who could he tell that he was glad he'd gotten laid off from such and such a job, and he was glad to be rid of it? Rid of it? Rid of it? Even the women he knew, with their sincere or insincere pose of being understanding, lost eye contact if you said you longed to be unemployed. A man who was unemployed was nothing you could put your finger on, but women felt an ancient dislike of such a man. Even Emma Jean now, and she had to be an original. If any woman was, even she would not admire him for wanting to quit. Even if the Rack publicity job had come his way directly through her father, she might now regard Vern as one more colorless rural lightweight. St. Fursey was full of them, lightweights. People who did a little hunting, at least they made sure to get out for opening. Some of them showed up to sing with the annual ecumenical Thanksgiving chorus. But they could not concentrate. Natalie Tenebrae shouted at them about making clean attacks. Please, would they watch her? Please, would they please? Just this once, watch her. So they all came in at once. It did no good. They heard her shriek. They saw the high color in her face. But what was it all about? The old lady all worked up about something again. He had already waited 3 or 4 minutes in the meeting room. A sharp-looking woman his age walked in. Of course, he'd seen her. He placed her. She was the president's assistant, dressed expensively in khaki and black, in the Twin Cities mode of the 1990s. Now he had to concentrate sensibly. Then she, someone, would of course want some evaluative comment from him. They would of course feel some chagrin when he gave his 2 reasons for leaving Rack. They would, wouldn't they? Somehow, he had pictured being able to talk to Rack's second in command, an older man with a kindly, too soft face. He had imagined a sentient leave-taking. He had made a mental picture of the vice president, silvery and gentle-mannered, who would twiddle a pencil and say, "Would it make any difference, Vern, if I told you that Rack's senior people have been deeply concerned about the same issues as you are, that we have every intention of working on them?" And here you would pause as if anxious not to be intrusive. "I have to say your name has come up a number of times because we would like to ask you to help with working up the new 3-year environmental stuff." Another pause here. Vern imagine then. "You're good, you know, Vern. You are the best out there speaker we have. Your conference breakfasts have made us some solid friends. Everywhere, even in the range towns. People in the schools say that kids actually love your lyceums. Do you think you could help us work this out, Vern? I guess I am asking you to stick. I guess I'm saying that what worries you at Rack, Cam, is exactly what worries us, too." Nothing like that was happening. The snappy young woman went around behind the huge table. She leaned across it to shake hands. She would like to help him, she said, with whatever he had on his mind. Good, he thought. Her role here is just office formalities. In a minute or two, she would call in someone who would accept his resignation. "I am resigning," he said. To her, he knew, he was a man acting on principle, leaving a job on principle, which meant he was a personnel problem, pure and simple. She was, or someone, would have discussed him already, since he had asked for an appointment. They would have figured him as an underling, a follower, a company person. She would have an ancient inborn hatred of people who think for themselves. He felt the jealous disrespect veering at him from her eyes. Apparently, she wasn't going to call in anyone. She would either, he he thought, accept his resignation outright, or more likely, he thought, she would bide for time by making him an appointment with some HR personnel. Rack now had on call not two, but four guided imagery counselors. They were very thin young men and women, in Brooks at the least, Armani at the most, whose language was slack and friendly. When you explained anything at all to them, their eyes became doe eyes, as if you had just proposed marriage. The eyes also said that whatever you were saying, they had heard it already, and it was non-controversial, and therefore didn't matter. Their invariable response to any insight was, okay, okay, okay. If you said, my name is Albert, and I've got this idea about E equal MC squared, they would smile and say, okay, okay. If you said, my name is Gautama Buddha, and I have this idea of an eightfold plan, right thinking and all, they would smile. That, too, would be, okay, okay. One morning when Vern had been in Rack only a few weeks, he made to join a crowd in the largest staff meeting room for the morning session of two spiritual journey teams' half-day programming for employees. The president of Rack saw him in the hallway. He grinned, but firmly caught Vern's elbow and pulled him away. No, no, Vern, the president said, smiling. He kept Vern's arm. They went into the man's office with its huge shining desktop and the small iron safe draped with a yin-yang symbol embroidered on black velvet. The Rack president said, you didn't want to go in there. Vern said, I didn't. No, hell, the president said. Sit down. He pressed a button. Mervyn, bring us a couple of coffees, will you? And open up the new box of the terrific stuff and bring us some and then go ahead and offer it around out there, will you? Mervyn left. No, hell, he repeated. You would die in there. No, we get those folksies in here for two groups only, the people who need them. Vern made interested noises. Marvin was back in the room with coffee, an old-fashioned salver of cream and sugar and four dark chocolate truffles. When Mervyn left again, the president went on. Group one is chemists and group two is support staff, the president said. They're the groups. If there's any one group who can't seem to develop any loyalty to the firm, the worst are the chemists. They don't even begin to get it about how you are family and whatever other philosophy you have, you want to keep in mind that the whole family needs. Maybe only a business family, yes, but still a family. Same with the support staff. Family, Vern, whatever language you want to use, the fact is, as a group, we have common goals, and you'd think they'd want to throw in with the company. But they never do, not really. Apropos, Vern, let me tell you a funny thing about industrial spying. You send out an industrial spy, right? They're supposed to find out the latest formula from the competition, right? You know what they really find out. They find out that 52% of our own chemists are bad-mouthing Rack everywhere. Not just in bars at New Year's, not just because they didn't get the Christmas bonus they wanted, not just in bars, but everywhere. And the support staff, they steal over 7% of our Hewlett-Packard LaserJet stock for their home computers, for their kids' computers. For all I know, they sell it to the mafia for their computers. The big man gave a fulsome, good-tempered laugh. He pulled the tin foil off a truffle and bit in half. Then he plugged the rest of it into his mouth, too. My God, but those things are good, he cried, when he'd bitten into a second one. So it's the chemists and the office gals who get the spiritual journey, not you. Vern asked, well, what do they make of it? They love it. They love it. The spiritual imagery people make the whole room full of them fill out an evaluation at the end of the session. They all say they love it. At first I used to ask them, when I was working crowd a little at the Christmas party or anything, you know, I'd ask them in so many words, what did they get out of it? I never met anyone, chemist or office help, either one, who could remember a single damn thing. But they felt so good. And it was a day of no work with full pay. You have to remember, those people are always slightly jeering about the company. They all sneer at RacksWeekly.com newsletter. At the same time, they have their noses to the screen, looking for mention of themselves. Try forgetting that some couple had lost their baby or someone got a ribbon in a new Brighton art show. Tell you the truth, I think they like it that the spiritual journey people get $30,000 a go from us for doing virtually nothing. We leak the figures around. I think they like the idea that the top brass are being played for fools. It gives them a hoot. Vern stopped stirring his coffee, but he began. To Vern's amazement, the rack president suddenly burst out laughing again. The laugh slung some chocolate juice onto the huge desk. The man mopped it up with his handkerchief. You know, I love those new kind of spiritual journey types. Back in the 80s, we got a very different animal. Back then, it was mostly overweight, middle-aged women who'd failed to build profitable private practices out of counseling divorcees. They'd arrived in their layered silks. Real silk, too, but they still looked like they'd floated clear from the ashram in Jersey City, if there's an ashram in Jersey City. They would glide slowly around the room like huge festoon barges. "Now feel the sun is hot over your head," they'd say. "Yes, hot, but not unpleasantly hot. And you are relaxed, really relaxed." But that was then, not now. Our personnel people stopped getting these people in, for whatever reason. Maybe those huge creatures with their clipboards have died off. I wouldn't know. Or maybe those women generated some specialty gigs, nurturing sessions of people caught embezzling or dynamic relaxation for prisoners caught molesting juveniles, whatever. Another fulsome laugh. Around 1995, we started getting these glamorous boy and girl teams. You could see our $30,000 three times a year right there in their clothes. Had 'em ever since. He laughed again. You know something, Vern? I think they've got more panache than greyhounds let loose at a puppy farm. I love them. His eyes squinted for a split second. You hire somebody to do some job, you look at what they do, but you also have to look at the crap they don't do. If you give them a grateful kiss, these kids in their this-year clothes don't call in the sex police from somewhere. They understand business is a trust thing, and workplaces are friendly places. Well, are they psychologists, social work background, or what? Vern had asked, feeling around for some neutral ground. Who, those lounge lizards? No, no. If I got a real psychologist or a real social worker, now that's what I call asking for trouble. No, these folks are business people. Relaxation is billable hours, so they do it. The man added, look, example. He laid his head directly onto the desktop. Left ear down, a pulpy-looking eye rolled up at Vern. I am relaxed, okay? Those people teach people to relax. Well, Vern, now, how much real thinking does anyone do who is relaxed? How much actual work does someone do who is relaxed? The president dangled his tongue out. Vern was fascinated to see that huge length of tug lay out on the tabletop like a banana slug. The president raised his head. No, he said, even if 66.66% of my company ever really relaxed, that won't be you or me, Vern. Thank God, you haven't been here long enough, but I've learned that much about you. You can work. RAC needs for you and me to do just what we are both doing, working our tails off. Signal to go, Vern thought. Time to go. Stand up, go. One more full-throttle laugh from the boss. But before the man opened the door to the outer services office, he said, fair warning about the real world, though, Vern. Those spiritual journey people are geniuses. Geniuses. They didn't learn how to stroke my company, for $90,000 a year from any state-paid council for small businesses, let me tell you. Geniuses. And at last he opened the door, his arm around Vern's shoulder, so whoever was out there would see that this was his man of choice for today. What can you do? He put on a half-witty, half-rueful expression. What can I say? RAC is a genius-loving company. Heads had looked up when the president opened the door, and Vern came out of the president's office to go through the general room full of cubicles. People at work were those scheduled for the second sitting of the spiritual journeyers. The door to a side office was open, the executive assistant's office. A slender figure in black and khaki silk blouse turned to her desk to regard him. "Yes," Vern thought, "they will all slightly hate me now," and he noted how satisfactory that was in a primitive way. Some were chewing gum. Some kept their feet behind the cubicle's modesty guards, but he caught sight of a loose shoe here, another there. That day, he now recalled, like today, had been a Friday too. So people slouched before their computers in Norwegian ski sweaters from Ely, Minnesota. Not all people obeyed the lower dress code for Fridays. Not the slender woman in that side office. Not the president. Nor did Vern. And now Vern heard his voice explaining that he wanted to quit. The young woman waited. His voice went on. His voice went loping over the course of his last year's work, his traveling around giving lectures to college students, high school lyceums to Minnesota, some Iowa high school teachers retraining. He had shown up as consultant for kids' science camps in Wisconsin. He had prepared all-day workshops for area chambers of commerce and regional development task forces, those that hadn't already been disfunded down to their socks. Oddly enough, he now explained in a low voice, he had never looked into Rack's Institute for Humane Research until it was stuck in front of him. He had just glided past the Earthburn 5 lab, the way your fingers slid over irrelevant listings in yellow pages. One day, he had arranged to be taken through the Institute, however, to complete his grasp of Rack's many entities. The woman regarded him with no particular expression. He couldn't get any sense of whether or not any others had quit for the reasons he was quitting. She said, "And what happened?" Her tone said he was giving a muddled report and should speak more clearly. But her tone also said she was a professional and would therefore patiently wait out his story, however kinky it struck her. Only once did her eyes flicker upward at the clock. Vern told her about two of the Institute's projects. One was a complex survey of diseases that ideally would have quick come on, but whose bacilli had to be impervious to weathering of any kind for several hours. Rack's interest in the project was the actual packaging of these microbes. They could be gelatinously or otherwise packed and kept with good integrity for extremely adverse conditions, extreme cold, desert heat, jungle humidity, and deliverable for use by non-technicians. They could be safely handled by briefly trained enlisted personnel. "That's right," the woman said. "What was the second project that interested you?" He told her about 5 Lab. The same time as the disease research was started up, 5 Lab reported in RacksWeeklyWord.com to be where staff were researching cures for red steel, a recurring curse to strawberry farmers. Vern had gone to look over 5 Lab then. In one of the lower levels, lighting blazed down on 4 rows of white enameled containers, each with a half-sized clipboard hanging from a hook below a hinged cupboard door. Out of the top of these containers stuck small animal heads. Those apparently in pain or general misery gave periodic screams, or simply twitched, their eyes now slatting shut, now opening their small mouths surrounded by white fur or white and black whiskers, oddly pink inside. The ceilings, Vern had seen, were low and made of negative acoustic material, but no one had yet invented the tile that drank up an off-directed screaming. Those animals able to sleep did so. They leaned left or right, jowl against the clean enamel container hole, the fur lopping over the enamel. An assistant approached Vern, coming from the other end of the lab, carrying a wide, clean white dustpan. In it lay 2 still animals. As he went along, the assistant lifted a paw or a paw that hung off the pan and curled it up against the animal's fur, giving it the look of a puppy cozily asleep.
You've been listening to Episode 5 of Shelter Half by Minnesota author Carol Bly. This book will run for 20 episodes through July 23rd. If you miss a day, remember that all the week's episodes are posted on our website, ktwh.org. Be sure to tune in again for the next episode of Shelter Half.